you saw me as a poet you were expecting, but anyway, it's lovely to be reading here. I was just thinking I'd read some poems that I don't normally read, just because it's nice to sort of come to one fresh. I could start off with a couple of poems from my first book. Can you hear? Oh, my gosh. Am I too far away there? Is that right? Or is this
good?
No. Okay. And I thought I would start off with a poem about cats, but when I was writing some of this book, I was working on Spike Island, and I wrote a series of poems about Spike Island because it was such a startling place that, you know, it kind of shocked me first of all, and I wanted to write about it. But the first one is called Spring Cleaning. The governor has decreed a full-scale poisoning of cats. An island tidier without animals. Death, the silhouette that slinks and struts from the shadow of a grey brown bush. To the shaggy marmalade that fixes you, suddenly owl-like from tufts of grass. To the mottled tortoiseshell that slips, brief as a ghost down the backyard path. To those that cross and recross the invisible cat path by my window. Death, 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 death. A tidy island, without animals. I don't know where the cats came from. I think they may have been sort of left over from when the island was lived on by army families. But the cat is actually full of them. The second poem is about one of the guys I met there. And he was very unusual. He was a fairly young prisoner. And he was unusual in that he was very much at ease there. And he was also very, very striking looking. And most of the times when you see prisoners in prison, they look sort of dejected. They don't bother to dress well. They kind of walk along sort of looking slumped, and wear the sort of prison issue clothes, not a uniform, but they sort of issue you with cheap trainers and cheap jeans and sort of sweatshirt. And this guy just looked completely different. And I think I was teaching English there quite a bit of the time, and he was in the English class. He was actually looking at something else. Joe in jail. Oh, Joe with the brown skin, deep coloured curls, and lips cherubic, serene like Medici page boy. You shrug cheerfully when someone taunts you speak with men. He's in here. Outside, will you pillow your face, deep breath in the white bag again? And fumes make strange images come in your brain, and your limbs dance like a madman. What you see then is the geography, primary tree. He took with such delight and pored over for a whole afternoon. So, a lot of the guys inside had missed out large sections of their education. Now, I remember in one class showing them how to map read, which a lot of them had kind of never looked at a normal survey map before. So I looked at the map of Cove, and he was from Cove, and he said, oh, that's why I was caught. And he never realised there was only one bridge off the Great Island, and the police apparently were waiting. So he finally really learned something. And finally, from this book, I want to read you some of the parts of the long poem the book got the title from. Again, it's about Spike. Called the island, and it is to do with my reaction to working there. and also the fact that a jail is a kind of completely locked away world. And if you want to, you can't just walk into court prison and see what it's like. You have either to be convicted of something or visiting somebody or else working there. And you sort of pass this place and it's like a completely different world, a completely different life going on close to where you're living. And like with even more of a separate world because of it being an island. And it's got a quote at the beginning, epigraph, as they like to call it, which is from John Mitchell's jail journal, because John Mitchell was locked up there in the 1840s. 28th of May, 1848. We came to anchor within 500 yards of Spike Island, a rueful looking place, where I could discern crowning hills, the long walls of the prison, and a battery commanding the harbour. May 29th. In this court, nothing is to be seen but the high walls and the blue sky. And beyond these walls, I know, is the beautiful bay lying in the bosom of its soft green hills. It will keep me here for many years. I will forget what the fair outer world is like. Gazing on grey stones, my eyes will grow stony. One, the journey. First, there is a web of bridges and islands, round like breasts, like a child's drawing of hills. From here the island is beautiful. You cannot see that the shape on the summit is a stone bastion. When the boats bore me first to the pier, the sea was glowing unearthly blue. The island glittered. It was crystal, wind-starred in the blinding morning sun. Placed this in mystery, the initiative of the month. It seemed less later, under a grey, troubled sky. The swans clustered by the leaves, the island, and the dark swell broke high. Or past tall bowlands, mist hung with the far shore gone, and boys struck at low water outposts of bleak, forgotten lands. Or by the ruined fortifications of the old magazine, where a ghostly redcoat might leap to challenge, not knowing the passage of time. Sometimes the place fills with ghosts, crowding upon me as the living leaves, until the soft thrud of the launch's engine wakes me to walk to the pier's edge. Three, the enclosure. Inside these walls you cannot see the world. Save at the edges, the great enclosure is bare of buildings, a moon-bleak surface of cinders and mud that dries to yellow dust in the spring air. Yet, despite shadows of unease, the shattered form of the old jail or the burned-out block, today is workmanlike. Spellings are learned, businesses sorted out, a kind of reality is touched, as the sun falls upon the geranium in the English room. Fourth, travel beyond the confines. I should say that the next bit is to do with going to Dublin, because after I'd been there for like 2 weeks, I went to a course in Dublin with other prison teachers and kind of heard about what was going on in those prisons. And this poem also, well, I was working at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, and that was the time when people were still, the women were in the old prison, they've been moved now, and also when they used to separate men who had AIDS, they sort of put in an isolation unit. But at the same time, they wouldn't give them condoms or tell them about condoms, because condoms were sort of not approved of in any shape or form. So, yes, four, to travel beyond the confines. But in Dublin, the winds cut sharp. On this ground, exploring is dangerous. Search is an institute, and you might scrape flesh, touch bone. Behind the grime streaked stone that towers above the house back, mind called bodies of heroes burn, and sounding above the engines at rush hour, the cries of the lost women, slashing, slashing, and blood trickling under the cell door. She is not like the others. Withdrawn, she contemplates an open book as morning breaks. lighting chips out for a pattern in her living space. Yet, with only time and a monthly sign to mark the passing of her womanhood, how much more could she undestroyed contain? Not much more. For given that one chance, she let them mount her behind the factory. Is it joy worth waiting for to feel that brief shudder of pleasure before the grey walls closed in again? Her body was fresh and sweet still, cream against the dark triangle, but her face had a grave look. The score deep under her eyes, shadows sank by the chief bones. Cry, the latter had. So what's to be done to stop him fucking when he's let out of the unit for prisoners of AIDS antibodies? Condoms are disallowed by the authorities, and the girls, not knowing, don't say no. Six, the female ward. And in the female section, even the copybooks are bleeding. Blotted and blotched on the yellow covers with tears, with brown blood, those pools, are they edged orange or magenta? For the women, not content to bleed with the moon, splash and hack at the whitish flesh with stones redden under the blood. Where's her copybook? Miss, her copybook is all covered in blood. Seven, the task. In the hushed room, we form a circle. To read the remembering pigeons, he tells how the bird released from the boy's hand soars real far out of the cage on the smoky roof. It is afternoon. Locked in the tepid air, we fight sleep and dream of release. And when the evening train pulls at last between rounded hills, I would press my head against them for peace. Eight, leaving. Eden and the island. As I reach the quay, walking on wet seaweed with the last storm thrown carelessly along the stone, brown pods pops from my boots. I stare under the rain-popped surface of the sea, where clouds mirrored in grey billow like ectoplasm, and a goat's head, then a bull grotesque as a minotaur, peer briefly, horridly, then disappear. And I search desperately over grey water that launched to wet me. Nine, to view from distance. Seaward, of course. Islands of evening time are glass-green stones inlaid upon sapphire, upon aquamarine. And great ships move in arcs around headlands, gliding in silence on the estuary. The island is enclosed, secret, gleaming softly in slanting light. Island of the blessed, these poor inherit space in the stone dormitory, seek oblivion in the needle sink, with only the grave to end the wandering of a damaged mind. On the island there is a graveyard, but the graves are numbered, featureless. They never left, but as I leave from far away it becomes only an island, shimmering in the light of early morning, lovely at evening time.
Okay.
No, I've got to check what time it starts.
You're fine. Maybe
not. I don't want to. Okay. Now, by the time I finally got Tucker's Mould published, when I was working on the island, I was actually painting as well, and I stopped. By the time I was doing this, I was partly because I realised I couldn't write and paint both well. I had to sort of focus on one thing or the other. And I think a lot of Tucker's Mull is to do with perception and how we perceive, because I wasn't painting physically, so I was sort of doing it through words or in my head. And all these poems are about places which are kind of well known in Ireland, but they're about trying to look at them differently, but trying to see them as if you knew nothing about them and you were just seeing them for the first time. And then say, if you ever go to some tourist place, whatever you do, don't start off by putting on those headphones they tend to give you now. It's fine afterwards, but if you want to sort of really feel how the place is, you need to go around and just without anything in your ears except your own voice. And this one is about visiting the Book of Kells, the Trinity College Library. At first, you see almost nothing. Then letters tumbling down the shelves. A high dark nave, light on the old spine of umber gold. On either side, the pale bowed heads of philosophers. Heart set with stones have the blurred tracery of interweaving on the shaft. In the uneven ancient glass, trees flicker by. I sped out carolus the cumbus, past the close-written text of an old manuscript, seen photographs, an old map of Paris. A new chamber holds the treasure of the place. Copies anesthetize the eyes. To see clearly you need to change them, start again. The thinness of it, as it sits in tea or old varnish. Even to look at it requires patience, the eye making out only a little at a time. You might follow the twists and whirls like a maze, but there is no ending. The thread strays, wavers, but remains the same. Only we, following the path, change. And another one, about tourist attractions, which probably they wouldn't be very keen on displaying. Enter Newgrange. And Newgrange is somewhere I've been to several times before this visit. I think I went as a child originally, and I've been back once or twice before, and you know, you sort of went to the bottom of the field, and there's a little kind of kiosk place, and you paint your entrance and wait for the tram to go in. And the last time I went there, there was this enormous tourist centre, and you had to go through this sort of convoluted exhibition which involves entering a replica of the place. Kind of very depressing. Anyway, entering Newgrange. Willow sways below the garden, and true bird song mingles with chorus. Which shall we desire? The real place on the windy hilltop, the simulated, under neon and glass, with stone pillars machined to an exactness that could never have achieved in the Neolithic. Low ground is a wilderness it would not have been when the builders lived there. Beyond it a bus driver berates the tourist who have lost his ticket. And then the great mound is studded with sunstone, seeded with dry, burned bones, a human river on the threshold of the curls of a giantess, past which the sun would penetrate again and again, now squeezed out by politicians. Returning, I break bilberries in my mouth. Watch how the sun lowering by glasses, fills the stone, makes each stem a wand of light. A lot of these poems were written when I was still living in Cork, and this one is about the sculpture going to the sculpture factory in Cork, and I did one or two bits of kind of sculpture, and they had a workshop on to teach people how to use a plasma cutter. Now, a plasma cutter, if you haven't come across it, is something that cuts steel with some kind of bar. And so we went, the group of us went to try it. I've never used it afterwards. But another thing about this is that for some reason I'm terrified of fire, and I always have been. I got more terrified when I was living out in the country, and there's been a gorse fire up on the hill, but it had more or less died down. It was sort of early evening, and I went into my house and shut the door. And kind of later on that evening, there was a hammering at the door, some neighbours saying, "Oh, we thought you might be worried about the fire." And I looked outside and there was this wall of flames. this was sort of kind of handling fire in a way, controlling fire, the sculpture factory. "The great boat lit suddenly by welding light as I passed dock land to reach the place. In the mask it becomes a dim point cutting steel. The plasma cutter dips points of fire that stab lightly at my arms, my feet." Another couple of short poems. Probably they're both haikus. They're not classical haiku with the right number of syllables, and they've also got titles, which I'm sure haiku shouldn't have. They're probably both about writing, although it's less obvious in the first one. "Heron, a barbed hunter stalking the mud marsh near Ennison." And then, "Poet, a whole day waiting for one word, and then what?" You all know the feeling. Another one about writing. It's also about the difficulty of writing, I think particularly if you're female, and conducting a relationship with somebody at the same time. if you're very wrapped up in your writing, it doesn't always work very well, and you just, however fond you are as a person, there are times when you just want to go away. Quite a long time. There's also the thing about being isolated, and possibly connected with my experience of the jail. I was thinking about Abelard and Eloise and being shut up in a place. And it's called Nunnery, which, if any of you have read your Hamlet, you remember it doesn't just mean a convent, it means poorhouse as well. But anyway, nunnery. "I would retreat to the nunnery of myself, where thought sprouts tropically, twining and pressing so densely I could grow a whole forest of it. It might take a year to tend, search away, bending branches through the thicket to some kind of clearing. Like Eloise, I would be enclosed. Only my call softly sometimes at night, or creep out once or twice a year to discover you." another short one. "They have been having miserable weather these last 2 days, but this is to remind you that it could be worse. About being in the country in November. November. Unsoftened by summer growth, stones are grey and pitiless. Silage bags glistening like black slugs. Berries saved to the colour of wine stain. Old blood." Another one written in Cork. "When I was living here, it was at the beginning of the Celtic Tiger boom, you suddenly began to notice how many, all the immigrants coming in. And it was almost a shock because Cork had been sort of cut off from the rest of the world in the sense that people didn't come here, or they left here, but they didn't come here particularly. And it was particularly striking with the African people because they looked so different from the Cork people. And I wrote this poem called Asylum Seekers. It's also to do with looking again, and it's also to do with political correctness. And I find political correctness, I can see the point of it, but I hate the way it sort of trammels the language. And in a sense it's totally futile because whatever words they kind of choose to call somebody that sounds better than the original lot of words. Yeah, to be sure, but once those words have been in use for a while, it's going to, they're going to mean exactly the same as the more attentive word that was going to replace. And also this, yeah, to do with prejudice and where prejudice comes from. One other point that, or probably or most of you are better at Irish than I am, but just in case you don't know, Fiacorum Gorham is the literally blue men is the Irish word for black men. We did not silent seekers. We did not meet their eyes, fearing their ebony faces might suck us in with a great smile, so dark, so deep, deep dark at midnight, or colours we call them, though we had no colour at all, were not pinkish or black, but if they were not all bronze and torn into deep burnt shot tips. For the fear gone, fearing those we were ignorant of, blue men from the bones of the Atlas Mountains.
Another 10 minutes.
Okay, sorry. I'll read one more from this book, and then I'll read a couple of new ones. This is another one written, of course. When I was living in Grafton Hill, and there was a sort of backyard that didn't really have anything growing in it, but next door there was another backyard which had a little bit of grass behind it, and it had a laurel bush that sort of gone out, gone tall, and nobody bothered with it, and it's really nice having that patch of green at the back. And one day I looked out, and the landlord who owned the house had come along with a saw and cut the whole thing down, and there was just put sort of pipes and stump, and I was extremely upset. And I started having vengeful feelings about all sorts of gardening and tidying up. So, this one's called The War. Hush. I will not tell them you are growing furiously, silently, from the stump they cut last year, your stalks seeming bare pipes and concrete of green shade. In the grey city, every green sphere is a guerrilla fighter missing freedom. Your shoots thrust out dangerously. Everywhere you erect leafy receptors to power your takeover. Showers fuel you as you crawl, bladed, armed, over rooftops, across dusty terrain, firing sudden pollen, an intermittent but deadly bombardment of seeds. Bees drone overhead, your agents. Birds swiftly got your grenades. You never rest. If we rest, you are up and away. Our apparent victory is temporary. And we are deaf to your troop movements. Do not know from which corner your next attack will be. Still we tear you from roots, shrivel you with lethal fluid, and you appear to nest away, leaving tangible corpses by the roadside, then comfort from another angle. The force is with your ragged troops. I will defect to your side, leave my garden to wilderness, don a bandolier of seeds, with my breath spray dandelions with four winds, scatter moss spores into concrete. There is grain hidden in my pocket, from the dry pods new green will grow. It's made in kind of nature fights back, and all this stuff about us global warming and us ruining the earth, it's sort of people make out it's that sort of concerned on kind of animals and plants, but in fact it's ourselves we're concerned about, because nature will survive fine once we're gone, so it comes to come back again. It's only humans that will disappear from the earth. Maybe some animals, but okay, that's a new one. Another one about a place which is visited by tourists. I don't know if any of you have ever visited this Skelly, the Skelly Michael, and it's a pretty startling place. Very scary. I was talking to somebody about the way the monks lived, because I read this book about the kind of things they did, the sort of self-mortifying things. And they said, so what, they must have been fucking mad. So it wasn't exactly why I wrote this, but it's sort of on that scene. On Skelly. If you should approach the island as I did week and six from the trip, it would loom from the mist like a mirage born of hope, or a drawing in an old book of fantastical stories. Above it, the twisting ancient steps, a pyramid of rock soars up. You have to trust the drop. And at the ledge that hangs over the swift fall of the slope, you see how the monks sheltered like gannets that cluster and shriek on the neighbouring islands. Are the places of refuge in blade-driven time, too far and too storm-tossed for marauders. And the sun laboured on terraces, laid the unending stairways. How many die feverish and spent on the stone floor of the shells? How many, maddened by fasting, launch themselves into the void, fancying they were seabirds or angels? Walk the 544 steps from the harbour, not counting or watching the sea under you, just fixing your eye on each freckled slab, bordered by the astonishing green of sea campions, up and up, until the needle and God's eye is reached, and God's heaven beyond. One French one, in French, by visiting the Matisse Museum in Nice. I'm not a tourist, I suppose places become tourist sites because they're striking. And about the practice of enshrining dead art practitioners, artists, poets, whatever, sort of not looking after them necessarily when they're alive. Seniors. I think that old Matisse would have laughed and been content to rest in dappled shade under the trees in Seniors, where children brightly clad sit under grey-green olives and industrious in sit under grey-green olives and industrious in homage clip coloured sheets for a collage. The high-res house is gracious, ordered, that befits the citizen, so thought it is. The city sunstruck, the park quartered again and again by gravel paths. The children chatter. Without them, high white walls would be too still, too cold if only with reverence. How far do temples serve? Might colour run and spill from glass to wall and out under the shading trees to children's toes, despite the too bright light that wipes out colour where it falls. Now finally, two about my mother, and that specifically, I tend not to avoid the subject of my mother totally, but she got Alzheimer's a few years ago. And it was just such a strange thing. I did write a couple about her. One about her and one about me, really. And Alzheimer's is quite tragic. It can be very funny at times because people do the oddest things. And my mother was always terrified of flying, and she flew as a young girl about the time of the Second World War with a boyfriend who I think looped the loop with her, and she never set foot in a plane again. And she came down one day and announced that she'd been to the moon. And is that good for me at my age? she always this point about a day when she, summer day, and she looked up into the clouds, and my parents lived south of London, and there's always just millions of planes in the air, and she said, she remarked on there being Dakotas, yeah, they sort of remember things. They can get their time muddled up. My mother sees Dakotas. My mother sees Dakotas cruising the scrolls, clouds south of London, stares, and then seems to come back to herself, tangled filaments in her brain, slowly disconnected, pockets of incident, incident in name, an organ grinder in London, a lost sweater, a man who seems to be watching. Her great-granddaughter is troubled by witches, one flown to the rooftop, that are also watching, but will eventually go away. And finally, one called Unravelling, and the problem, and not only the problem of the sadness of watching somebody decay mentally, and the problem of sort of coping with them as they get more incapable, but also when you have closure, you have Alzheimer's, you can't help wondering if the same thing is going to happen to you, and it's of course such a horrific experience that you would not want it to happen to you. And this, yeah, so this is called Unravelling. If I claw for a spelling, struggle for words, is it lostness or part of my thought unravelling, elderliness creeping in at the back of my head? Fear flickers through my skull as I wonder do links crack and fall out, like old machinery wearing as it thumps away in a shed or corrodes in a long-forgotten warehouse. Would they lie on the floor of my brain like broken springs, gap-toothed wheels I could pick out to make new fantastical structures if I dusted them, cast them to sculptures I could erect for the worthy to admire? Yes, but who'd want a crazy, knowing old flea bag? Who'd care that the me that conformed and rushed away into the distance, that dribbling, friendly hag was taking her place? Crazy Jane might be fine as a notion, but the real Mackay is hard to take. A bewildered old zealot, or a woman who stares and sees marching across the sand and the order.